Right, brief introduction again.
Yeah, so this will be a whistle-stop tour, brothers and sisters, through 100 years of history from BC 800 to BC 700. And it's quite a challenging subject. I'm quite glad I took it. I'm quite glad Anne gave it to me because I think it's quite useful to do this sort of thing. And it did actually teach me one thing. So if we look at kings and prophets, first of all, we've got a number of kings of Judah and a number of kings of Israel. When you look at the list with respect to Judah, you can see we've got five kings: Amaziah, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And we heard a lot about Uzziah from Brother Simon Turneycliffe's son-in-law, whose name escapes me.
Andrew
Shenold came and gave us a talk, and it was principally on Uzziah. It was an excellent talk as well, I thought, very good. And of course, that is the reign, really, that dominated the period 800 to 700. Now, I've got Uzziah on there as being a 27-year king. In reality, there is a co-regency issue. And for many, many decades, the Bible scholars were all at sea with respect to the various time periods that these kings lived, until a man called Teal, as part of his thesis for his doctorate, he looked into the matter, and he worked out that, in fact, the two separate kingdoms had two different ways of measuring the length of the reigns of the kings. Not only was there that an issue, but an added level of complexity was that there are, for example, items where kings had them and their son reign together. So Uzziah, for example, was co-regent with his father Amaziah. So you'll find out that Uzziah, if you look at some textbooks, it will tell you he reigned 52 years. He reigned quite a few years with his father. So son and father were together. The same with, particularly with Uzziah and Jotham. We know that Uzziah became leprous during the latter part of his reign and couldn't actually meet, couldn't go to the house of the Lord, because he was a leper, couldn't meet with people, and his son Jotham effectively reigned for about 11 years of his 27 years. So there is a co-regency issue. When you look at the Israel side, what strikes you very clearly is that there's a lot more kings on the Israel side than there is, that's the 10 tribes of course, than there is on the Judean side. And when you look at the reign lengths, you can see Zechariah, Shalom, and Pekahiah, they were only about a year each, or 2 years in the case of Pekahiah. So you get the impression here there is a less stable, I was going to say strong and stable, because that's Theresa May's watchword, isn't it? Strong and stable government. That was before March of this year when it all went wrong for her. But you can see these kings here on the Judea side are obviously a lot longer in length than what was going on in Israel. So clearly more stability, which you would expect, temple, centre of worship, more godly kings on this side of the equation than there are on the right-hand side there. And of course we notice that Hezekiah, it drops into the next century, the reign of Hezekiah. He goes through the millennium and into the next millennium, century, whereas of course Hosea finishes at 722, because 722 was when Samaria fell. So from 722 there was no further king of the 10 tribes of Israel. Now if we take Judah, the prophets that effectively witnessed during the period of those kings was Isaiah and Micah. Now, Isaiah, we notice, of course, goes on like Hezekiah through the end of the century and into the next. He prophesied a very long time. So we have two prophets who were prophesying, witnessing. Mustn't forget, of course, that they were both actually later than the prophet Jonah. Jonah was round about 786, 746. And fascinatingly, his prophecy, of course, is focused on Assyria. It's focused on the city of Nineveh. Quite interesting, isn't it, that the first writing prophet doesn't write anything about Israel or Judah. He writes about Nineveh. And we'll have a little bit more about that later. I think that's quite intriguing. Quite an intriguing little mystery, that. So, I mean, the prophecy itself we know well. It's a fascinating prophecy. Not very long. Obviously, many messianic things in Jonah's prophecy to do with resurrection. Death and resurrection in particular. But I found it fascinating that here we have, other than Jonah, we have these two prophets, Isaiah and Micah, prophesying to these Judean kings. And when we look at the Israel side of the equation, we find we've got Amos and Hosea. So, two more prophets. And I think we've got here a principle, brethren and sisters, the Mosaic principle, which, and it's fascinating that God demonstrates his respect for the Mosaic law by sending two witnesses. Two witnesses were sent to the kings of Judea, two witnesses were sent to the kings of Israel, because of course, out of the mouth of two witnesses, a man or a woman could be convicted under Mosaic law. If you're accused of something and there's only one witness, it's not enough. You have to have two witnesses under Mosaic law. And if those two witnesses agree, the evidence they give is the same, then two witnesses is all you need to convict a man or a woman. And God was sending his witnesses. And when I sort of read into this, other texts suggest that actually they're more like lawyers. I mean, Amos was a herdman of Tekoa. He was a keeper of trees, amongst other things. You never call him a lawyer. But nevertheless, what he was doing with Hosea was reminding the kings of Israel about the covenant, the marriage covenant, effectively, the covenant made at Sinai. And God is trying to bring his estranged wife back to the covenant. The wife who had gone away to other husbands, to other false gods. God's trying to bring them back to the covenant by two witnesses or two lawyers. So it's fascinating just seeing both sets of kings, both had two witnesses apiece, obviously respecting the Mosaic principle. So if we look at Judah, Judah is slightly easier to summarise because we only have five kings, and so doing a summary of them is useful because clearly, in some cases, the kings were very good and there were lessons to be learned. And of course, they were effectively the ones who were the custodians of the law, but custodians also of the temple and the people. Now, if we take Amaziah, he's praised basically because his father, of course, before him had been murdered And Amazar, quite rightly, he apprehends the murderers and he executes them in accordance with the law. And in accordance with the law, he spares their children, which of course wasn't the practice that was carried out in those days. And in those days, if you killed a man, you killed his children, because there was every chance his children would seek revenge for the death of their father. But not so under the law of Moses, and Amaziah is approved for that. He then has a battle with Edom, he recovers Edom. Edom had rebelled, he recovers it. Of course, Edom, of course, had been subjugated in the days of David and the days of Solomon. But they had rebelled during the period, and he recovers Edom. But then, incredibly, he then covets their false gods. And so he makes a big mistake. And then the mistake is compounded, of course, when the prophet of God is sent to challenge him. He basically threatens the prophet of God, and things get worse. He then incites King Joash of Israel to battle, and unsurprisingly, when you've got 2 tribes versus 10 tribes, there's every chance you're going to get defeated. And he was. And the 10 tribes then decide to loot the temple. So the temple was looted, and they knocked down part of the wall of Jerusalem. And of course, as a result of all these things that he brought upon his own kingdom, he was assassinated at Lachish. But that allowed his son Uzziah to come to the throne, and what a difference. This king is completely different from his father. Co-regency, according to Teal, for about 24 years. Did that which was right, prospered in all his areas, and of course he loved husbandry. And the cities were built, the defences were strengthened, the army was reorganised. It was a strong nation, rich nation. And eventually, of course, as we know from the address that we got a few weeks ago on this subject, pride led to his fall from grace. He offered incense, not his responsibility to do that. He assumed, he usurped the authority of the Mosaic Aaronic priesthood, and for that he was afflicted. And interestingly, there was obviously an earthquake during his kingship, because Amos, the prophet to the 10 kings, the 10 tribes rather, in Israel, records it in his prophecy, chapter 1, verse 1. So there's obviously an earthquake as well in the days of Uzziah, which is an interesting event in itself. Jotham, the son of Uzziah, who was co-regent for about 11 years, it's reckoned, he built the upper gate of the temple, built cities of Judah in the mountains, fought against Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, king of Israel. So Rezin and Pekah decided to get together. These were the local bullies, and they decided they were going to come along and have a go at this smaller contingent of Judah, and he fought against them, and it's recorded for us there in 2 Kings 15 and verse 37. And then we get his son Ahaz, and it's interesting, we get a bad king, we get a really good king, we get a half-decent king, which Jotham was, and then we get a shocker, and this is Ahaz. And to a degree, you have to say, this young man came to the throne at the age of 20, so he wasn't very old. But immediately he ascends the throne, he's put under pressure by Rezin and Pekah to form an alliance. Because, guess what? The 2 bullies on the block are now being bullied themselves by an even bigger bully. And that bully is the Assyrian king Tiglath-Pileser III. Now, Tiglath-Pileser III is a heck of a mouthful. So I simply refer to him as TP3. Far easier. His Babylonian name, by the way, is Pul. So if you see the word Pul, it's the same person. Okay? So his Assyrian name was TP3, Tiglath-Pileser III. His Babylonian name is Pul. But that went one better. He decided, well, I've got these two bullies over here who are trying to bully me into going into them to face that bully over there who's even bigger. I think I'm going to go and talk to the big bully. And that's exactly what he did. Completely, of course, against the advice of the prophet Isaiah, and really, faithlessly, deciding that he would sort himself out an alliance with this Assyrian king, rather as his grandson would do, sorry, as his son would do in later years, which is to pray to the God of heaven for strength and help. And we read in 2 Kings 16 and 18 that having gone to meet Tiglath-Pileser, he goes to Damascus, he goes to appeal to him, and in due course the bully from Assyria has dealt with Rezin. He captures Rezin, he captures Damascus, executes Rezin, executes him, doesn't bother, just kills him straight off. And Ahaz goes to meet him at Damascus, and Ahaz sees all these images, all these Assyrian images and altars, and decides he's going to set up an altar that he's seen from Damascus, which was all to do with what TP3 was worshipping. And he changed the pattern of Mosaic worship. So Ahaz not doing very well, not in the divine scale of things. I would say he was found somewhat wanting. And then, of course, we get the golden king himself, which is his son. And it's interesting, isn't it, how you get fathers who don't abide by what the Lord wants, and then you get sons who absolutely do. Hezekiah, of course, mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus, obviously witnessed the destruction of the northern kingdom by Sargon's Assyrians in 722 BC. As we know, he enacted sweeping religious reforms, doing away with Ahaz's altar and all the rest of it, celebrated a Passover at Jerusalem, to which the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh were invited. They didn't go, by the way, but lots of other Israelites from the 10 tribes did go. Zebulun went, Asher went, but of course there were those who just laughed when the invitation came. But perhaps the most crucial event of the whole century, right at the end of the century, he survived the siege of Sennacherib in 701, which was a triumph. A triumph of his faith over the faithlessness of most of his nation. And of course, Isaiah's prophecy has much to say on this, as it does, interestingly, with his succumbing to his pride. Can we just have a quick look at our Bibles at Isaiah 39? Because it's all set out here from about chapter 37, 38, 39. Cover the main points, but at chapter 39 we get at that time Merodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he had heard that he had been sick and was recovered. Well, of course, that was all very interesting. He wasn't really that bothered whether Hezekiah had recovered or not. What interested Merodach-Baladan was that Hezekiah had somehow defeated 185,000 Assyrian troops, and how did he do it? That was what really interested Merodach-Baladan. And if you get Brother Harry Whitaker's commentary on Isaiah, I mean, Brother Harry says quite unashamedly that from chapter 1 to chapter 39, I have a fairly good idea of what's going on. And he says from chapter 40 onwards, he says, I haven't a clue what's going on. And this is where a brother called Andrew Perry, the book is in the library, brothers and sisters, I do suggest you have a look at it if you can. But Brother Andrew Perry has covered chapters 40 onwards. Brother Andrew Perry is a scholar, an Old Testament scholar. And what he has established, I think, beyond a shadow of doubt, that these chapters, chapter 40 onwards, particularly the chapters that talk about I am God and there is none else, this is all to do with the Babylonian ambassadors coming to see Hezekiah. God is incredulous through the prophet Isaiah that Hezekiah is having any truck with these Babylonians. What on earth are you talking to these Babylonians for? They know nothing. Their gods know nothing. They worship false gods. And all these chapters, chapter 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, are all passages that deal with God appealing to Hezekiah to think again. Don't put your trust in these Babylonians. They will do nothing for you. They know nothing. I am God, there is none else. And of course we get these wonderful passages, you know, Bel, Stupor, and all this good stuff. And God is setting out here in these chapters. And I think Brother Andrew Perry has actually got a good handle on these chapters. In fact, he's written a commentary from chapter 40 through to the end of the prophecy. And he's put these chapters into their historical context. And certainly these chapters are going on from chapter 40 of Isaiah, all to do with the Babylonian envoys. And of course, the prophet Isaiah speaks out, doesn't he? He comes to see Hezekiah. And he predicts that as you have trusted in these Babylonians, your sons and your grandsons will be eunuchs in the court of these Babylonians, as Daniel, of course, was. And we know the reason why they were made eunuchs, don't we? We know why they were made eunuchs. The Babylonians and the Assyrians, if they made people governors of a particular area, they made them eunuchs because they didn't want any seed succeeding the governor and therefore establishing a kingly line or a line of succession. That's why the Assyrians and the Babylonians made men into eunuchs. So there was no danger of there being a son or a lineage. So these governors, when they were dead, they were dead. Their line would die. And that's why, in due course, Daniel was made a eunuch. Very sad. A dry tree, as we are known they are called in the Old Testament. But particularly before we go and look at the tribes of Israel, tribes of Israel and their events and messages, I'd just like us to finish up a little bit and look a little bit in detail, because there is one. I did hint at this at the start of my comments about Jonah's prophecy, because it's always baffled me as to why Jonah, the first writing prophet, should be talking about the city of Nineveh. Now I think this is a speculation on my part, but I think it's an interesting speculation. Jonah prophesied somewhere in the period 780 to 740, long before Sennacherib, who was of course BC 701, attacking Hezekiah, was probably born. But the record tells us that the prophecy of Jonah, that the work of Jonah in Nineveh, the city humbled itself. It was going to be destroyed, and it humbled itself. And it was subsequently saved. God saved the city. Now, Sennacherib's city, interestingly, was Nineveh. Nineveh was the great capital. I think there's something like about 8 miles of walls they found. They found the city. It's been discovered by archaeologists. If you go to the British Museum, you'll see some fantastic stone panels taken from Nineveh. The British absolutely found Nineveh, and all the treasures came back, and they're currently in the British Museum. You must go, because there's literally rooms with all these wonderful stone friezes on. And it was a great capital. So what puzzles me is that already in the record, and we needn't go there now, but we know from the record in Kings that Sennacherib had already taken some tribute from Jerusalem before the great stand that Hezekiah took, that great faithful stand that he took. There had already been a payment made. So you wonder what on earth's going through Sennacherib's mind, because this lot in Jerusalem, they paid up, they're a nice little source of income. But he then decides he's going to destroy them. He's, having taken the money, he's going to destroy the whole thing. And of course, if he destroys something, there will be no more revenue. There'll be no more knocking on the door in about 2 or 3 years' time and saying, give me some more gold. And I just wonder, brothers and sisters, if this is payback by Sennacherib for the humbling of Nineveh that was undertaken by Jonah, and of course through his God, the God Yahweh, the God of the Jews. Because we notice when we look at the record, and we'll look at it in a few moments, in Isaiah 37, God uses that expression, rage. He says to Sennacherib, I have seen your rage against me. Sennacherib was a conqueror, and he was a businessman, but he was a conqueror. But for some reason, against Jerusalem, he was in a rage. And I just wonder if this is an anti-Semitic rage to do with the humiliation that his own city had suffered through the hands of Jonah. Now, when we look at the record, let's have a quick look at the record. Isaiah 37. There's some subtle changes in tone here. If we look at Isaiah 37 and we go in at verse 6, we read this. We'll take verse 5. So the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah. Isaiah said unto them, thus shall ye say unto your master, thus saith the Lord, be not afraid of the words that thou hast heard, wherewith the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Behold, I will send a blast upon him. Revised version margin. Behold, I will put a spirit in him, and he shall hear a rumour and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. That's what the prophet Isaiah tells the servants of Hezekiah when Rabshakeh has made his speech. Okay, that all sounds very fine. But what happens next? Verse 8. So Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria warring against Libna, for he had heard that he was departed from Lachish. And he, that is Sennacherib, heard say concerning Taharqa, king of Egypt, he is come forth to make war with thee. So this must be the rumour that was set out, that the king of Egypt is now coming up to do battle. But what happens next? When he heard it, when Sennacherib heard it, Sennacherib sent messengers to Hezekiah saying, verse 10, thus shall ye speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah, saying, let not thy God in whom thou trustest deceive thee, saying, Jerusalem shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Behold, thou hast heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all the lands by destroying them utterly. And shalt thou be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered them, which my fathers have destroyed? Gozan and Haran, Rezep, the children of Eden, which were in Telassar. Where is the king of Hamath and the king of Arpad, and the king of the city of Sepharvaim, Hena and Ivah? And Hezekiah received the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up to the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord. So Sennacherib writes a letter. And as I say in my comments here, what a foolish letter it was, because he should have taken the hint, shouldn't he? He should have taken the hint. The Egyptian king's coming out to meet you. You need to break off what you're doing in Jerusalem, gather your forces, so you've got a united army, not split forces. Gather all your strength, go meet the king of Egypt, or clear off back up the coast and go somewhere else. He doesn't do that. He sends this letter. And of course, we then get the response of God, don't we? Because now he's written this letter against God. Verse 21. Then Isaiah, the son of Amoz, sent unto Hezekiah, saying, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, whereas thou hast prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria, this is the word which the Lord has spoken concerning him. So this is the words of God himself. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, hath despised thee, Sennacherib, and laughed thee, Sennacherib, to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem hath shaken her head at thee, Sennacherib. Whom hast thou reproached and blasphemed? Who do you think you are? And against whom hast thou exalted thy voice and lifted up thine eyes on high, even against the Holy One of Israel? And so we find here a condemnation, the like of which I would suggest we find nowhere else in the Old Testament. Here is a Gentile monarch being called out by the God of Israel. It carries on, verse 28, doesn't it? But I know thy abode and thy going out, Sennacherib, and thy coming in, and here it is, thy rage against me, and thy tumult is come into mine ears. Therefore will I put my hook in thy nose, my bridle in thy lips, and I will turn thee back by the way which thou camest. And verses 33 and 35 finish off, brothers and sisters, the rest. And of course, as we know, the exterminating angel was unleashed by God. The 185,000 troops that were camped around Jerusalem wiped out in an evening. And now he has got to go back, because now he has lost a sizable part of his army. He has to retreat. And fascinatingly, as we know from the secular record, Sennacherib never came back. Now, he didn't die immediately, brothers and sisters. It was 19 years later when Sennacherib met his fate. But he never came back to this part of the world again. And interestingly, he's murdered by his sons, and he's murdered by his sons in the temple of his God. Fascinating, isn't it? God protected Hezekiah. But Sennacherib's God could not protect him, even in his own temple, not from his sons. Fascinating. So, Israel. Well, there's a lot of kings in Israel, and there must have been n number of events that went on. In fact, we know there were. But But there's only one event that really matters. And this was the event. Anybody know who that is? Anybody want to hazard a guess? Tiglath-Pileser the third. There he is, in all his detail. That's off one of these stone friezes in the British Museum. It looks a fairly unhappy man. He doesn't look like somebody you want to trifle with, does he really? And I notice he's got a wristwatch on him. Right, so I don't quite know where he's obviously well ahead of his time. This was the event, brothers and sisters. The petty squabblings of the kings of the 10 tribes with Judah and Syria and others were as small potatoes, I would suggest, in comparison to the arrival of Pul of Assyria, or as his throne name was in Assyrian, Tiglath-Pileser III. This man was the progenitor of a long line of despotic, cruel kings. He was prophesied by Balaam, Numbers 24, verse 22. Tell us about the rise of Asher, the nation of Asher. And of course, the judgment of this nation of Assyria is prophesied by Nahum. The whole prophecy is against Assyria. And of course, Zephaniah speaks of the demise of the nation in chapter 2 and verses 4 and 15. So Tiglath-Pileser III, well, he usurped the throne. So there was a civil war in Assyria. These are thugs amongst thugs, basically, just one set of thugs against another set of thugs, and this thug won. But this was a thug who'd got a brain. Whatever we might think about this gentleman, he had got a brain. And what he did was, he established civil, military, and political systems and structures which actually meant that the Assyrian nation carried on until at least 625 BC. And a lot of the structures and systems that he put in place were copied. So the likes of Nebuchadnezzar structured his empire on the basis of what Tiglath-Pileser III done, and the Persians, and the Greeks, and doubtless the Romans as well. He established the first professional standing army, and he organised it on superior weaponry and tactical lines. Tiglath-Pileser's army could fight all year. It was a 24/7, 365 army. There was no other army like it. The armies in the days of the kings of Judah and the kings of Israel, they fought after the crops had been brought in. When the harvest had been brought in, then it was time to fight. But until the harvest had been reaped, no fighting. Well, that's not how TP3 worked. His army was professional. It could go anywhere. And if you look at the list of nations he subjugated and deported, Mesopotamia, Babylonia, Chaldea, the Arabian Peninsula, 10 tribes of Israel, Philistia, Moab, Edom, Phoenicia, Armenia, the Scythians, etc., etc. And he deported them. He knew what he was doing. Once he'd taken Israel, as we know, he deported the people to other places. So they were now stateless. They weren't going to cause any trouble where they'd been deported to, because there was no infrastructure to support them. And he'd move people who were not Jews into the Israel territory. Again, they didn't know the territory, didn't know the area, completely new, no structures. The ability to resist was therefore minimised. Clever, clever man. Terrible upheaval for the people involved. Absolutely cruel and ruthless. But that's the way you rule in that time. Now, how did TP3 interact with the kings of Israel? Well, a number of references here. We probably won't go to these because time is running out, but we know, for example, that King Menachem paid 1,000 talents of silver. 1,000 talents. That's a lot of money, even in today's exchange. 1,000 talents of silver to TP3 at the request of Ahaz. He defeated Pekah, 2 Kings 15. He deported Israelites. We're told that in 1 Chronicles 5:26. We're told that he uprooted a lot of the tribes, the 10 tribes, and put them in other places. He installed Hoshea as a puppet in place of Pekah. He was, of course, the last king in that line. In October 729, he captured Babylon. This was the zenith of his power. He deposed its king, and on New Year's Day, apparently every New Year's Day in Babylon, the king would take the hand of Bel each year. And on New Year's Day, having crowned himself king, he took the hand of Bel in Babylon, and he proclaimed himself a priest king. So this is a clever man. Not only has he got the military organized, he's got the civil world organized, the politics organized. He's now going to organize the religion, and he's going to meld religion and military power together. What a mix. What a mix. Not only has he got the threat of violence, but he's also now going to shackle and chain the minds of men and women through religion. And we had that address the other week, I think, and we looked at Isaiah 13 and 14. And I think Isaiah 14 is the demise of Tiglath-Pileser the third. He is Lucifer, son of the morning, that's depicted in Isaiah 14, and his end is ignominious. And it says he has a vaulting ambition in Isaiah 14, which absolutely speaks to this man who, quite literally, in his day and age, was without any compare. He touched the heavens as far as he was concerned, and by becoming the king of Babylon and taking the hand of Bel, I mean, you had to go up that ziggurat to the top. That's what they used to do, right to the little chapel on the top of the ziggurat to touch heaven. And of course, he is in Isaiah 14, he is brought down low. So I call this final slide because when you've been having a slide presentation, it's always nice to know this is the last slide. I always ask somebody who's doing a slide presentation, how many slides have you got before you start? Well, why do you want to know? Well, I want to know when you're going to get to the end. So this is the final slide. King's Prophets, Events and Messages, 800 to 700. So it's a with a whistle stop tour around 100 years of history. The big mystery for me, though, in this study is the fact that Samaria was destroyed in 722, and yet there seems to be nothing, no record, no prophet seems to have spoken about the destruction of Samaria. I find that stunning. You'd have thought there'd have been something on it, wouldn't you? I mean, Samaria is the home of the 10 tribes. Now, we already mentioned Isaiah 13 and 14. I'd just like to tantalisingly ask you to turn there for our final reference, because Brother Harry Whittaker, a brother who I have the highest regard for in terms of his studying abilities, has looked at Isaiah 13 and 14, as have other scholars. I think when we had that discussion the other month about these two chapters, I think Brother David Brown covered them. I think I said at the time, chapter 13 and 14 are a unit. They are to be read together. They're not separate chapters disassociated from each other. I mean, this is why it's always a bit of a conundrum. When you look at chapter 13, verse 1, it says the burden of Babylon. And then when you look at the end of chapter 14, verse 24, it says, I will break the Assyrian, sorry, verse 25, I will break the Assyrian in my land. And people go, well, it kicks off with the king of Babylon, that's Nebuchadnezzar, surely. And it finishes up with the king of the Assyrians. But it's not. Because Tiglath-Pileser was king of Babylon and he was king of Assyria. So this is an oracle against Babylon, but it's an oracle against the king of Babylon, who is Tiglath-Pileser, who was both. And Brother Harry makes that stunning point in his analysis. And he then goes on to look at this chapter 13, verses 1 to 16, because we've got this issue, brethren and sisters. In these verses, we've got sun, moon, and stars of heaven. Now, as we know, those that you go back into the history of Israel, you go back to the patriarchs, to Joseph, the sun, moon, and the 12 stars bowed down before him in his dream. The sun, moon, and stars, brothers and sisters, I would put to you, are always Israel. They're always Israel. They're not Babylon. This sun, moon, and stars here cannot be Babylon. Because if it is, it means that you've got a confusion. Sun, moon, and stars surely could only be Israel. And when you look at this second verse of this 13th chapter, lift ye up a banner upon the high mountain. The high mountain. Anybody ever seen where Babylon's located? It's in modern day
Iraq.
It's by the river Tigris. It's as flat as a pancake. There's no mountain in 10 miles of Babylon. And yet it says here in verse 2, lift ye up a banner upon the high mountain. The Revised Version margin has the bare mountain, meaning the levelled mountain. Now that is absolutely, brethren and sisters, potentially a description of Samaria. Samaria was a levelled mountain. Samaria sat on top of a levelled mountain. And Brother Harry suggests that this chapter here, chapter 13, 1 to 16, is the destruction of Samaria by the Assyrians in 722. Now, if Harry is right, this is the only reference, brothers and sisters, we ever have to the destruction of Samaria, because there's no other references. There's no other place that describes it. And I find that fascinating, that something as momentous as the taking away of the 10 tribes from the covenant land would not be referred to somewhere in a prophecy. But I'll leave it there. I've gone off long enough. Thank you for listening. I hope you found that useful. And I'll look forward to doing something next year, and possibly on 700 to 600. Why not? Thank you.